You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome Nafees Hamid. He's a social psychologist researching terrorism and radicalization. He's a fellow at Artis International. He's associate fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism at The Hague. And he's a visiting researcher here at the Santa Fe Institute, where we are speaking. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So what led you to this work, researching the psychology of terrorism?
Well, my background was actually in cognitive science and the study of how the mind works. And so I was studying moral psychology and moral decision making. And actually before that, in a previous life, I was actually an actor. I was a stage actor doing work in different theater companies around the U.S., regional theater, and then some television work in Los Angeles. And I happened to meet another researcher named Scott Atran, who was an anthropologist who's well known for speaking with people in different violent extremist groups of all stripes. And I told him about my background as a cognitive scientist and as someone who studies moral psychology, and he was interested in that. But he was more taken by the fact that I was an actor, I think, than the fact that I had this scientific background. Because he said, that's important. That means you can talk to people. That means you'll have the ability to improvise if something goes wrong, or to really empathize with people who you can't sympathize with. And then he said, why don't you come work with me for my organization, Artis International? And since then, it's just been a world of field work and interviews with members of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, or people who came back or people who wanted to go, and neuroscience and psychology experiments.
How do you initiate contact with people? I mean, for those of us out here in the regular world, what do? You call them on the phone? I mean, how do you find these people to talk to and then build relationships?
So there's no formula for how to do it. In 2014 and 15, there was a lot of guys who were in Syria who were members of either the Al-Qaeda affiliate, Al-Nusra, or ISIS, who were on Twitter, and they were open about, you know, who they were fighting with and where they came from. And so I could just reach out to them, and then we would sometimes talk on Telegram or WhatsApp or SureSpot or Kick Messenger. And in some cases, they asked me, you know, why don't you come all the way out to Turkey, to the Turkish-Syrian border? We'll meet over there, and then we'll have some coffee or something, because they were quite comfortable at that time. Coming in and out of Turkey. Turkey hadn't really closed off its borders yet. They still sort of saw the insurgency as not really affecting them too directly. And so there was these very porous borders, so you could go meet people there. At other times, you meet people. I've met people in prison. I've met people who have defected, and they were going through some kind of pre-trial process. Someone in government introduced me. Sometimes you just kind of spend enough time embedding yourself in certain vulnerable communities, and just kind of through a snowball effect, one person introduces you to another person, you come across someone who's a recruiter or someone who's really thinking about going, and maybe they're not 100% sure, which is why they reveal it to you, and then you kind of build a relationship from there.
What are those relationships like? I mean, do you bond? Do you affect their lives? Do they affect yours?
It varies. I mean, sometimes it's just one meeting and then I won't be able to see them again. Sometimes I'm able to see them continuously over months and months. They affect me in the sense that I do start to care about them. And in some cases, people I talked to eventually ended up dying in a battlefield somewhere. And it did affect me emotionally because it's someone I got to really know and hear about their life story. In a few cases, I was able to meet the actual member of the terrorist group, as well as the family members of that person as well. So I was also able to sort of project what they must be feeling, and that just obviously adds to some of the pain. In some cases, I have, I think, inadvertently been able to make people question some of their thinking, even though that's not the direct point of my work. The point of my work is to meet them and to try to understand their motivations and to try to do studies. And then eventually, the hope is that the conclusion of the work eventually leads to some policies that down the line will lead to less of this propagation of these networks. But sometimes through conversations, I've actually been able to intervene without necessarily trying to intervene.
And we'll get to that, because I want to talk to you about what is actually going on in these networks. But the question of, I mean, who you are Pakistani-American. Do you tell people to whom you're talking, I'm a social psychologist and I want to study you? Is that how you approach them?
Exactly, yeah. in the beginning, even if I tell them I'm a social psychologist, I think they pretty much treat me like a journalist. And for the people who are active members of the group, they see me or a journalist or any other researcher as a potential mouthpiece to help get their propaganda out, which is their motivation for agreeing to have a meeting. But once we sit down, I start telling them I'm a social psychologist and what I study, I actually find that that's what breaks the propaganda. In the beginning, they're just kind of telling me standard fare stuff, whatever, you know, the latest meme that came out or the latest language that was in a particular issue of an ISIS or Al-Qaeda magazine. They're just propagating, you know, what they've heard before. And then once I start telling them about some of my research, they kind of just turn off. They stop at the propaganda and then they just become curious. It's almost like a really curious student. They start asking questions about identity and values and what parts of the brain activate when someone thinks of this. Have I noticed any differences between, I don't know, someone like in the Tamil Tigers or IRA versus someone in ISIS? What's the difference? And then they just kind of become curious at that point, just like a student, and you're just teaching them things and their mind is expanding. And then it's through that they kind of start opening up and revealing things because it kind of breaks their rhythm of the propaganda.
Let's talk about who these people are, what their motivations are, where they're coming from. What have you found in your research?
Well, the first thing is that it's evolved a lot over time. There was research done by two researchers at the University of Oxford, Stephen Hertug and Daniel Gambetta, and they were looking at the educational backgrounds of people who joined a jihadist group anywhere from 1970 to 2010. And what they found is that these people were coming from sort of educated backgrounds. They were probably middle class, upper middle class. Of course, you had people like even billionaires like Osama bin Laden. But many of them had, I think the statistics was something like you were six times as likely to have a bachelor's degree if you were a member of a jihadist group than the general background population. And I believe it was something like 17 times as likely to have an advanced engineering degree, which is one of the hardest degrees to get accepted into, especially in the North Africa and the Middle East region. So those are the best and brightest, the smartest students. And those are the people who they were kind of attracting. Now, the reason, we're not really clear why there's so many people who have engineering backgrounds who join these groups. And this is true even for other terrorist groups. It's true for FARC. It was true for other organizations. But there is some research to show, actually, that engineers and then people who are members of like far-right extremist groups have certain cognitive features in common. They don't like too much cognitive complexity. They prefer cognitive closure. They like black and white answers to problems. They don't like gray areas. They have a tendency to in-group and out-group. They also have a propensity for moral disgust as a justification for why something is wrong. Whereas people with humanities backgrounds, for example, tend to like gray areas and complexity, and those are the least represented people in terrorist groups, all different kinds of terrorist groups, not just jihadist terrorist groups. And that's not to say that, you know, being an engineer, being, you know, having a humanities degree is going to buffer you in some way. It actually just shows probably that you have some sort of cognitive propensity that can either make you want to go get a degree in this field, but also makes you vulnerable for being pulled into one of these groups. However, in the last 10 years or so, you don't see this sort of elite profile anymore, highly educated. What you're finding more and more of is people from marginalized neighborhoods, especially in Europe. It's a lot of second generation kids of parents who came largely from North Africa, but other areas as well. You have a lot of converts, too. You have a lot more women today. In France on the watch list, about 35% of the people on the watch list are women. 33% are converts. A lot of petty criminals. So, yeah, it's evolving. But it evolves because the goals of the organization evolve as well. So they target different populations. So, for example, in 2012, there was very few women that went to Syria. In 2014, one in seven foreign fighters leaving from Europe was a woman. By 2016, it was one in three foreign fighters leaving to Syria was a woman. If you just think in terms of vulnerabilities, you're going to come up with some bizarre conclusion like women became more vulnerable over the course of 4 years to radicalization, which makes no sense. I mean, the whole gender can't become more vulnerable. What happened is that the organization's goals evolved. In 2012, it was largely a local insurgency, and so the need was for young men of fighting capacity. By 2014, you have the declaration of the caliphate. So ISIS now changes its strategy from an insurgency to a state-building operation. And for that, it needs women and children and people of all different kinds of age and educational backgrounds to help legitimize their state by coming into their territory. Once those women are there, then they start reaching out over social media to other female friends, selling them propaganda, selling them on how great life is, and this creates sort of a social pull to attract more women. And that's why you see the jump in 2016. So when you're thinking of, you know, who goes, there's no real one type of profile. You kind of have men, women, converts, educated, uneducated. It really depends on sort of where the organization is and its evolution at that moment, and specifically the kinds of people they're trying to target.
You're talking about a couple of different terrorist groups. Which groups are we talking about right now?
Right now, the groups I've mostly focused on are ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Do they have a top-down leadership that is setting those goals and setting those agendas and evolving, as you're talking about?
So Al-Qaeda classically did not. Its structure was what's called networked cooperation. Basically, you have a series of autonomous cells, and the leadership was not really a leadership. It was almost more like a funding organization. It was propaganda and funding. So you had people like bin Laden who were out there talking to the media a lot and putting out audio and video messages. But people would oftentimes basically come up with a project themselves, and almost as if Al-Qaeda was like a venture capital firm. They would kind of come to them and present the idea, and if they liked it, then they would fund the project. They might add a couple more guys in saying, well, you know, you need this specialist or that specialist, or you should come to this camp in Afghanistan, like the Durranta training camp in Jalalabad, and maybe spend a year here and train and do some theological studies. It was, especially in the 90s, it was very important to Al-Qaeda that the people who were joining were sort of pure, and they were joining for pure motivations, and they would vet to see if you were psychologically unstable, or you just kind of going through a weird period in your life right now, and that's why you're acting out, in which case they don't want you. You'd actually get pushed out of the system, because the attitude is we can invest a lot of training in you, and then you won't even carry out the operation because now you're in a different emotional state, and you were just volatile, and a volatile person probably is not going to do a good job of carrying out like a complicated clandestine attack anyways. And not only that, but actually when bin Laden met a guy named Abu Musab Zarqawi, who was the founder of what would eventually become ISIS, he was the founder of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, bin Laden didn't like him in 1999 when they first met for two reasons. One was he thought he was a little bit too extreme because he had this ideology called takfirism, which basically means even if you're a Muslim and you're a moderate Muslim, but you simply don't agree with our extremist versions of Islam, then basically you're also an infidel and now I can kill you as well. And bin Laden did not believe in that. Maybe he didn't believe in it also for strategic reasons, that you need at least some moderate, I mean, I hate using the word moderate Muslim, but you know, you need people who basically don't agree with your value system, but may nonetheless still support you because of monetary reasons or whatever. But he also didn't like Zarqawi because of the fact that he had a criminal background. He thought, this is not the kind of guys we want. Even though Zarqawi's eventual organization, like the profiles would be known for having a lot of petty criminals in it. So yeah, Al-Qaeda didn't have that sort of top-down structure. It was autonomous, separate little cells. ISIS did have a top-down command cadre structure because it controlled territory in a way that Al-Qaeda never did. So the structure of an organization depends also upon the territory that they controlled. I mean, Al-Qaeda was based sort of in the mountains of Pakistan, which they didn't really control that territory. They were just kind of being hosted there, and they were in Afghanistan as well, where they were being hosted by the Taliban. But ISIS had its own territory, so they had a real top-down command cadre structure. And potentially, yeah, when you look at the propaganda, you can tell that there's active attempts to recruit women now, or to recruit converts, or to recruit criminals. You can see it right there in the literature. So at some point in the hierarchy, someone's making the decision, let's actively recruit these people.
It does sound bizarre to hear a leader of an organization that kills thousands of people at a time saying we don't want criminals in the organization.
Yeah. I mean, I think that probably reflects bin Laden's point of view at that time, which is that in their mind, they see themselves as holy warriors, right? So they're sort of imagining themselves as some kind of samurai type, you know, figure, that they're part of this ancient tradition of mujahideen, these Muslim warriors, and that's why they wear certain regalia and clothes, and even suicide bombers will clean themselves before they kill themselves. They go through a bathing process and they shave off the hair on their body and they wear, you know, special white clothes and so forth. And so there's this puritanical aspect to what they're doing, and they really believe in the purity of what they're doing. and they look for ideological justifications in their fighting and in their acts. And the idea of, at that time, the idea of a petty criminal joining them was just, this person is just some delinquent who's kind of a sullied person and we don't really want them. The ISIS strategy was, this is your pathway to redemption. You may have had all of that horrible stuff happen to you. In fact, one of their pieces of propaganda that they put out in the UK was an image of a guy, and you're looking at him from the back, and he has kind of an AK-47 slung over his shoulder, and around him it says, sometimes the people with the worst past have the brightest futures. And he's walking into like a bright beam of light. But then again, I think in the case of ISIS, it was more just strategy. We just want more people, and these are a vulnerable population, so let's take them. They were less committed to this puritanical idea.
What is the end game of these groups? What is it that they're fighting for?
I guess in the long run, the idea is, you know, to have a worldwide caliphate, where there's no borders between every country, and it's just all a caliphate, and everyone lives in it. And the idea is Christians and Jews can live there, because they're people of the book, they're part of the Abrahamic faiths. They have to pay something called a jizya, which is like a tax for living there. Otherwise, they're left alone. They can practice their religion. And anyone who's not part of the Abrahamic faiths, Christian, Jew, or Muslim, has to convert or die, basically. For Al-Qaeda, that was a very long-term goal. I mean, bin Laden never expected the caliphate was going to happen in his life. I think for Al-Qaeda, the more short-term, the more immediate goal was a series of Islamic emirates, maybe similar to what was attempted in Afghanistan with the Taliban in the late 90s. What I just described there about the caliphate is very long-term, a little bit pie in the sky for a lot of jihadists. Maybe not the people who were part of ISIS in 2014-15, they really believed it. But I think the more immediate appeal is, look, these countries that we're living in are basically fictitious countries. Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, they were created after World War II by, you know, a Sykes-Picot agreement, where basically the British and the French just took out a map and drew arbitrary lines on the map and along mountains and rivers. And they said, so, you know, we're not living in actually the territory we created. These are false national identities that we have. Our leaders are basically not proper representatives of our people. They're puppets of the West or puppets of some government or just individually corrupt people and dictators. You have a lot of Western influence in that region because of all the natural resources there and Western troops on holy lands, and they're not happy with that. And so on one hand, it's just sort of the need for self-determination and to have their own state created by themselves from the ground up, and sort of dignity and the fact that they can, instead of fighting amongst themselves, break down some of these borders and work together and collaborate and to become independent and strong enough to be able to be a powerful force on the world scene. But I would also add, I think there's a lot of people who are not part of ISIS or Al-Qaeda who basically agree with that as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, those are ideas. I mean, if you take out the terrorist tactics, that a lot of people could get behind. I mean, there's a lot of people in this country who rail against colonialism for good reason, for historical reasons. There's a lot of false borders drawn in a lot of places in the world. I guess what's so hard to understand is how they think they're going to win by sending a plane into a building or sending a bus through a crowd. That just turns people against them.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say two things about that. I would say one is a lot of the people who go and join these groups, in some cases they join because of things like that. And they have like a desire for vengeance and they like the blood and the gore and they think that, you know, these people who are dying deserve it, and so they join for that reason. There's other people who join in spite of those things. That's not really why they went there. And they actively try to avoid talking about those things. So if you talk to members of ISIS or Al-Qaeda, more Al-Qaeda even than ISIS, and you try to force them to think about specific terrorist acts, what they always say is that's the 1% that you're paying attention to. I'm paying attention to when we're fighting Bashar al-Assad, and when we're trying to stop the barrel bombings from happening, and when we're pushing out criminals from areas where we're patrolling the streets, where we're opening up zakat offices, where we're giving money to people, where we're turning back on water and electricity into certain towns that we've controlled, that we're pushing out certain Shia militia that maybe have been abusing certain individuals. So for them, they sort of frame, again, this is a percentage of the people who join, they frame what they're doing in terms of that, and they actively try to ignore the terrorism. And, you know, I was talking to this one Dutch member of Al-Nusra, the Al-Qaeda affiliate, and he was talking to me about 9/11, and he was saying, you know, well, you know, 9/11, we attacked U.S. economic infrastructure. And I kind of didn't know what he was talking about. I thought, was there an attack on Wall Street or something? What is he referring to? And then I realized he was talking about the World Trade Center attacks. That was the financial infrastructure. And I said to him, how can you possibly call killing 3,000 innocent civilians like that, over 3,000 innocent civilians, an attack on economic infrastructure? And I told him those are mothers, those are children. I mean, I want you to really think about the lives that were lost there. And he thought about it for a second, and then he did the standard strategy, which is to say something like, oh, but you know, Americans kill so many of our innocent civilians as well through drone strikes. You just call it collateral damage, but there's something like whatever. I don't know the exact number, but something like 150,000 people who were killed in Iraq, and only a small fraction of them were actual members of Al-Qaeda or some group that was attacking Americans. So he's saying, yeah, they're killing 10 of our civilians for every one we kill of theirs, and that's kind of being generous. And I was saying, okay, but you agree that that's wrong, right? I mean, that's your whole point, that the killing of civilians by the Americans or whoever is something bad and that's not justified. And he goes, yes. I go, so how are you justifying your killing of civilians if you agree that that's not something you should do? And then I could kind of tell he realized he was backed up into a corner there, and he thought about it for a second. And he said, okay, you know what? If you want to say 9/11 was a mistake, maybe I'll accept it. I'm not saying I will, but it's maybe you're right. You can still be for an organization for their overall goals and yet be critical of individual tactics that they use. And I've heard this again and again where people like laugh and say, do you think that we all support everything our organization does? Of course we have debates amongst ourselves that was not justified, that was wrong, we shouldn't have done that. Both because it was strategically wrong, but also because in some cases I think it was morally wrong as well. So you do have that heterogeneity of attitudes. But overall, the organization's reason for wanting to use terrorism or kill civilians has been laid out in a variety of different speeches and texts. There was one book called The Management of Savagery in 2004 by Abu Bakr al-Naji, and then Bin Laden also gave a speech around that same year kind of explaining why they do terrorist attacks. ISIS came out with an issue in Dabiq, which is their English language magazine, called Extinction of the Gray Zone, where they elaborated on it some more. But basically the strategy is kind of just, well, first of all, this is sort of an unfair fight. That's usually how they first of all start. You know, we don't have the same weaponry that they have, so therefore we cannot have a traditional war with these organizations. So first of all, we're forced into using some of these tactics. And secondly, part of the purpose of the attacks is to kind of have a death by a thousand cuts approach, that for every $1 we spend on an attack, they're going to spend $1 million or $10 million in retaliation, and we'll bleed them dry that way.
Do you think that's working?
Well, I don't see the organization, I don't see any of these countries necessarily being bled dry. I mean, they still seem to have resources. But it's, I mean, in terms of the math, yes, that probably is the more or less the discrepancy in terms of how many resources a group like Al-Qaeda is spending versus a country like the United States is spending. So yeah, they are making us spend a massive amount of funds. I have no evidence to show that this is really having a detrimental effect as of yet. But of course, those are funds that are not going towards other things like education and healthcare and so many other things that are actually probably killing more people per year, from car accidents to whatever. And the resources are not going there. So that's, yeah, there are more people who are presumably dying even in the United States, because there's money not being spent on those things, instead being spent on terrorism, which is killing very few people.
Not to mention the surveillance state and looming authoritarianism.
And so, yeah, those are the other reasons for why they carry out these attacks, is because they want this counter-reaction. And this was, ISIS called it the extinction of the gray zone, where they basically said, look, you have a lot of people who are not really for us. They're not, in their ideas, in the white zone. But they're also not necessarily in the black zone of being pro-American or whatever. They kind of fall into this middle area called the gray zone, where they don't really know what to think. And the idea is, if we carry out enough attacks that we can create a backlash specifically towards the Muslim population, and we can help basically extreme right-wing politicians get into power, we can have immigration policies get passed in those countries such that the Muslim population start to feel even more marginalized, they start to feel that they're actually being persecuted not in some sort of metaphorical or symbolic way, but in a very practical, very real way that they are being persecuted. And their hope is that this will push some people who may be sort of fence-sitters or have mild sympathies for the organization to go over the edge and actually join us. And so that's been an active strategy, which is why they have put out propaganda with Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen in France. And there's sort of this strange symbiotic relationship between right-wing groups and these jihadist groups, that the right-wing groups gain more popularity and support the more you have these sort of terrorist actions, so it's good for them. And then the jihadist terrorist groups have this impression anyways that the rise of these groups help push more people towards them.
Whether in a place like the United States, these kinds of actions are pushing more quote-unquote moderate Muslims or more Muslims toward sympathies with terrorist groups, that's pretty questionable, but the rest of it seems to be working exactly according to plan.
Yeah, it is. And you know, you definitely do see, and I mean, I work in Europe, so that's kind of more the communities that I know of. A lot of the guys I know who did eventually end up joining ISIS or Al-Qaeda, their political radicalization started, and even though I don't think this is radical of them, but their politicization started with combating extreme right-wing groups. So they started with protests against the rise of, like, for example, in the UK, the rise of the English Defence League. So right now, just for like the last year or so, I've been investigating the life of this guy named Junaid Hussein. Junaid Hussein was this basically very left-wing anarchist hacker as a teenager. And he had this own group called Team Poison, and they worked with Anonymous, but they were more sophisticated than Anonymous, you know. If Anonymous was the infantry, these guys were like the special forces, if you will. They were much more capable, but they were still teenagers. In the beginning of Junaid's life, and I talked to his friends and family and people who knew him, from what they told me, he was basically just against discrimination against Muslims in the UK. He was against like things like the English Defence League or other organizations like that, and he would go to protests, but he would hack their websites, he would hack their Facebook accounts, he would like change the images there. He went to jail eventually because he did a couple things. He hacked Tony Blair's personal assistant's email account and released the address book online. Those were like his children, his family members, even sitting MPs and members of the House of Lords. And then he did what's called a denial of service towards this counterterrorism hotline for the UK police. He goes to jail, he comes back out, he seems to be a little bit more active, and he eventually goes and joins ISIS. So he goes from a very left-wing anarchist hacker who's railing against the establishment and specifically caring a lot about the plight of the suffering of Muslim people, to eventually joining a group that is responsible for killing very many Muslim people. Jihadist groups kill more Muslims than they kill any other group in the world. And he becomes the head of their cyber caliphate and starts hacking all sorts of things. And he becomes, I think, like number two or number three on the kill list, of the U.S. kill list. And eventually he was droned in 2015, and he inspired a lot of people. He released even home addresses and phone numbers of people in the U.S. military, and he did a lot of hacking and stuff. So here's an example of a guy whose pathway just started with this sort of legitimate grievance that there are these people who don't want us in their country. And I remember this thing when he hacked one of the EDL websites, he put up a message from him on the website. And one of the things he said is, "Why do you want me out of your country? Just because the color of my skin is different, but the color of my passport is not different than yours." And so he kind of starts in this very legitimate concern, but that becomes the cognitive opening, along with prison and then meeting the right kind of recruiters and so forth, that they were then able to play on that and eventually push him over the edge.
So let's talk about that process of recruitment. I mean, we read in the media that recruiters, or that kind of radicalization, is facilitated by the internet. But your work suggests that it's very much of a kind of local phenomenon, that it's based on personal, in-person contact, relationship building. What does that look like?
Yeah, so, I mean, if it was just the internet and people were just being recruited online, we wouldn't see these hotspots in the first place. The majority of people tend to come from maybe two or three areas, or sometimes more, but they come from just a handful of areas within a country. And so if it was online radicalization that was the primary source for recruitment, you wouldn't expect to see that. You would expect to see even geographical distribution of recruits. The fact that you have these hotspots shows that there are significant offline factors that are better explanations for why people are joining. Although a lot of people probably, their radicalization process is a mixture of offline and online, because they do eventually go and look for videos and they try to chat with people who are in a particular area or a particular group that they want to join to kind of get an insider point of view on things. So it's not that the internet doesn't play a role, it does, but it's more facilitatory. The actual radicalization process, I mean, it varies. Usually you kind of have a small group of friends who have a lot of time on their hands, and sometimes they can be a group of petty criminals. Sometimes they can be just a group of friends who play soccer together. Usually they're living in some kind of marginalized neighborhood. They have some awareness, they have some sort of politicization already in place, but it's nothing violent and it's nothing unreasonable, actually. It's pretty legitimate grievances that they hold on to. And then they'll come across someone who we would call a recruiter, but I mean, recruiters are just basically anyone who recruits. It's not like it's a formal job that you have or that you got some, you know, you got some title from the organization itself. I mean, anyone can just decide, I'm going to start actively going out there and proselytizing and trying to recruit people. So they usually come across one of these guys who, for whatever reason, has decided, I'm going to actively try to get people on the bandwagon here. And that person usually will seed an idea into one member of the network's head, basically. And then that person will usually go to their friends and then they'll start talking about these ideas. Maybe they'll start watching some videos. In the beginning, they're probably going to watch a mixture of videos produced by the organization that they're considering joining, as well as verifying some of the information by going to like CNN or BBC or whatever to actually say, hey, are these statistics actually accurate? Is this true? They're actually vetting the veracity of the propaganda. And a lot of the propaganda actually it's true, like the statistics are actually accurate.
Things like how many lives the U.S. has taken or Western powers have taken in Muslim lands, that kind of thing?
Exactly, yeah. Or like how many people Bashar al-Assad has killed versus how many people ISIS has killed. Or like they'll show like some videos, like these are the videos that you're seeing of, you know, what we're doing, but here we're going to turn the camera around and you can see all the other stuff that we're doing as well. Yeah, so things like that, those kind of statistics. But that's usually not enough. Then they'll continue to talk, and it's kind of an echo chamber effect where sometimes they're just hanging out in the same room together or in cafes or in park benches, and they're just talking about these ideas a lot with each other. And when they notice that there's someone in their friend network who maybe does not agree with what they're talking about, they just kind of cut that person out of the network. So it becomes increasingly insular. It becomes an increasing echo chamber where they're not actually hearing any external voices or any reasonable voices. And they're increasingly watching less and less of the non-propaganda material because they're not checking it anymore for its truth. They're just watching the propaganda information. But usually even there's people like family members who know that this person is actually going down this pathway. And oftentimes, you know, I've talked to mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters of people who went and joined these organizations, and they tell me, look, we kind of knew. And there was even a period, probably around 2013, where they were going to police and they were saying, hey, I'm worried about what's happening to my sibling or my son. And at that time, the laws in Europe were such that they really couldn't do anything about it. Like, we can't arrest him for a thought crime. The laws have changed, and so now there are prevention programs they can put them on, and even for viewing propaganda, they can arrest them. But now sometimes the punishment is so harsh that the families don't want to go to the authorities because they think if I go to the authorities, he may not end up doing anything or she may not end up doing anything, our sister or daughter. But if we do go to the police and we put this person in jail and then they might really radicalize and then we've lost them forever.
That's hard. I mean, either way, yeah. If you can't do prevention programs, it's one thing if the prevention programs are so harsh that their families didn't want to put them in. I mean, it's no win.
Yeah, I mean, there's different programs that I think are out there that are a little bit softer, even though in the UK it's criticized a lot. It's a program called Channel, and in Denmark there's another program. In our house, there's another program, it's called InfoHouse. And basically what they do is if they catch you early enough and they deem that you actually are somewhat, you know, radicalizing, they'll try kind of a softer approach. They won't put you in jail. They'll just meet you for a cup of coffee and they'll say, listen, we know you're going down this pathway. And if you resist and you just continue to go down this pathway, then you may end up in jail and not you won't end up succeeding in anything. But you can come and talk to, like, one of our mentors, for example. And a mentor could even be a former member of one of these organizations, someone who did fight in a foreign land and then came back and was arrested and has now de-radicalized. And that person will sit down with this young person and say, all right, well, tell me why you're interested in this organization, what you think it represents. And then they'll slowly, through building up a relationship with the individual, start to convince them, listen, I was there. I fought with these groups. It's not what you think it is. This is the reality. And they'll get them out of the echo chamber of their friends and start introducing them to other people who have different points of view. I mean, sometimes they can be also other reformed individuals or people who are going down the same pathway as them. They can even have like little support groups and they can pull them out. So you do see these kind of more softer prevention approaches that seem to be working. But you've really got to find the right person at the right time and introduce them to the right person for it to actually work.
Does it have to be somebody who, let's say, looks like them or is of their background or who has had that experience?
It doesn't necessarily. I mean, I think that's generally the programs try to find individuals who are like that, who have some credibility because they were former members of the organization. But really, I think it's just one, it's emotional. It's an emotional rapport, an emotional relationship with an individual. As I always say, that the messenger is as important as the message.
Right.
And so if you really feel that someone is willing to listen to you and hear your grievances and willing to talk with you about these things in a reasonable way and not just write you off as some kind of extremist or terrorist, that person will open up to you. And I mean, a lot of times, you know, when I was doing work in Molenbeek, which is a neighborhood in Brussels where a lot of the guys who carried out the 2015 Paris attacks and the Bataclan concert hall and then the March 2016 attacks in the metro station, the airport, they came from this one neighborhood. And when I was talking to the family members and even I met a lot of people who were on their pathway to joining one of these groups as well, and they kind of broke off for various reasons. And when I asked them, I was like, why do you think that this one neighborhood, it was so successful? These recruiters were able to recruit so many people. The one thing they said is the recruiters were the only guys who were talking to us. We're on the street. For the most part, we don't have good relationships with our families for whatever reasons. We don't have good relationships with authority or establishments. It's 60% unemployment or something in this neighborhood. We don't have a lot of future prospects. So most of us are part of this, what they call a parallel economy, and basically means that they're dealing drugs or something, doing something illegal. And we just have a lot of time on our hands, and the recruiters came, and they were the ones who were, you know, not only, they weren't lecturing to us. They weren't, when we think of recruiters, we think of some guy coming and, like, giving this big spiel that's going to, I don't know, you know, almost like a teacher, you know, trying to teach a student. That's not the way the recruiters actually talk to people. They listen, first of all. They really try to hear what your grievances are. They really try to understand what's troubling you in your life. They spend a long time listening. And then they find a way to take whatever your grievances are, whatever your vision of the world is and the problems you have with it, and then grafting that on to their movement and say, actually, that's what we're fighting for. That's what we're about. And all these questions and these injustices that have been whirling around in your head, there's actually a structure to these grievances. There is a framework. There is a narrative. And we have that narrative and we have the solution.
I heard an amazing program on Democracy Now! Last year. It was actually right around the time of the Barcelona attacks. They had a man on the show who was helping people to come out of neo-Nazi groups. And what he said was that his approach was to listen in an empathetic way, not to argue with them, not to debate, and listen for what he called potholes, things like job loss, lack of housing, other life skills, other problems, and then help them fill those potholes. And then when they were better equipped to function properly, then they didn't need to blame somebody else for their own problems. And they would come out of neo-Nazism. And they would become more self-confident. They would take their place in society. So it's so interesting to me that that process of listening and finding what people's vulnerabilities are can be used really in any direction.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the recruiters are better at it, or they're doing more of it than everyone else. So, like, again, when I was in Molenbeek and I was walking around, I was talking to all these people. There's a lot of NGOs that are there. There's a lot of money being thrown at that neighborhood by the government in terms of trying to create counter-radicalization policies and so forth. The problem is that most of these initiatives are not actually reaching the vulnerable populations. As one guy said, he goes, yeah, I'm sure there's civil society groups here that are probably going to try to help us. But their doors are open, but we still have to walk through it. No one's coming out here and talking to us. No one's actively building that relationship. It's just some faceless organization that has, you know, an office in that building, and there's some flyers around that I've seen about it. Whereas the recruiters was not, ISIS was not a faceless organization. The recruiters, the people they were talking to on Skype, they were actively reaching out to people through Facebook. They were saying, give me your phone number, I'll call you. Let's have a video chat. Talk to someone that I know who's living in the neighborhood. It was it was a lot of face-to-face, even if it's virtual face-to-face interaction. And then, again, it's the messenger that's as important as the message. And you build that rapport and that relationship. And then you're willing to go with that person. And so I do think that a lot of these organizations, these civil society groups, they could be so much more effective than they are if they were just actively going out and talking to people.
Okay, so you have recruiters who are out there talking to people who really believe, but they're still getting people to put themselves in a position where they're willing to die, to give their lives, to make huge sacrifices, to not have a future. There are people in movements here in the U.S. who are willing to die for the cause, I mean, even for environmental causes, things like that. What's the difference between that person and somebody who's like, yeah, I get what you're saying, but I still want to have a life and a family and not die?
I think there's probably lots of reasons for it. I'm sure there's personality differences for why some people would want to go do that, another person wouldn't want to go do that. There's probably things about counterpoles or what I call social anchors in society that this person has already some meaning in their immediate environment, whether it's through friends and family, whether it's through career aspirations, or whether it's even through religion. They may just have something very meaningful holding on to them. You know, people who are very religious, Muslims, for example, in Europe, those are usually, they're not the guys who are going to the mosque who are being recruited. It's the guys who don't go to the mosque, who don't have some religion, something meaningful in their lives, who kind of have this vacuum, this empty space within themselves, where they don't feel particularly attached to the social environment around them, nothing particularly spiritual in their lives, no hopeful prospects for the future. Those people are sort of unmoored, and they don't really have even a strong identity oftentimes, but they don't feel identified with their country of origin, they don't feel identified with their country of domicile. So they're kind of these free floaters that are just, you know, unattached from anything. They're particularly vulnerable. But I will tell you about another story, because sometimes we, as a social psychologist, I think social psychologists oftentimes make this mistake as well. We tend to, what's called a fundamental attribution error, where you assume that a behavior that you're observing in someone or some group is caused by some internal properties of the individual, a personality or values or something, when the reality is that it's probably something much more situational. So, for example, there was some research done on Palestinian suicide bombers. And they noticed that men who would go from Palestine into Israel had a very high rate of actually detonating their suicide vest. Women had a much lower rate. When they would get there, they would sort of back out. And the standard explanation for this in the beginning was, well, women are the softer sex, they have more empathy. When they're in that environment and they're looking at the faces of the people they're going to kill, they can't go through with it. That seemed to be a reasonable explanation. However, when you actually look at the weeks leading up to these people carrying out the attacks, you see some kind of funny patterns emerge. Usually, the way an organization like Hamas, but doesn't have to be Hamas, will actually prepare a suicide bomber for going into an area, is that they'll take that person, they'll put him in a safe house, basically, for about a month. And in that house is just other suicide bombers, and they don't let them out, and they control all information going in. And basically the information that's going in is just a parade of very important individuals telling them how great you are, this is amazing what you're going to do, your name will be remembered for forever in history, you are saving the Palestinian people, your family will be taken care of. So they're really psyching these people out and building them up and building up their egos. And then each individual guy within the home is also co-radicalizing each other. And then you take that person, you put them out, and they then carry out the attack. The thing is, the way Palestinian society is structured is that it's easy to get a young man away from his family and put him in a home for a month. The guy can just lie to his parents and say, hey, I got a temporary job for 1 month in this other town, so I gotta go, and I'll see you in a month when I'm back. It's very difficult to get a young woman away from her family, because her husband will ask her, where are you going? Or the parents will say, no, you can't leave on your own. But occasionally they are able to get these women into these women-only safe houses, because let's say a daughter is studying in a university, let's say far away from the home, so she's living in a dorm or something. So in those cases, they are able to get women to these homes. And then when they looked at the success rate of women who were in these homes, when they went in to blow themselves up, their success rate was the same as the men. So it had nothing to do with gender. It just had to do with the situation, the circumstances, the weeks leading up to what they were going through.
One of the things that you have talked about is that radical culture can be kind of like a youth movement, like anti-establishment, that connects people who are, as you say, disaffected and don't really have an identity and are kind of free-floating. That connects you to other people, not only in your community, but around the world, who share your ideas and ideals, and it's subversive, it's underground, you feel like you're changing the world. It sounds like any number of movements, like the 1960s counterculture. And when you think about these NGOs that you talk about, even if they did go into the community, they're not offering that, are they? People who are trying to de-radicalize.
Yeah, there's not a lot of, I mean, to some degree, you know, an establishment can't offer an anti-establishment narrative. And there's nothing wrong with being an idealist or wanting to make the world a better place. But yeah, the goal is to get them to avoid violence. And to some degree, you can't compete with that narrative. I mean, I think that's sort of a false idea that we're going to compete, we're going to challenge ISIS's narrative of changing the world in a world revolution. I mean, there's no NGO or no counter-narrative online or offline that can possibly compete with that. What you can compete with is just basically giving a person a sense of meaning and purpose in their own life and giving them the opportunities to be able to affect change in society. So if they want to start their own group, based around some, you know, value system of their own, and they want to fight on behalf of that cause, those resources should be available to those individuals. The uncomfortable truth that I oftentimes tell policymakers and politicians, especially in Europe, is I say, you know, you think of these young guys who went and joined these groups, they're petty criminals, living on the margins of society, been in and out of jail a lot of times. You sort of think of them as your worst. They took the worst from our society, and then they made them even bigger monsters. But the sad truth is that these are people who could have potentially have been your best. These are people who basically said, I am willing to sacrifice my life, literally, not just my energy, but my life, in order to fight for something that I believe will make the world a better place. Now, of course, they're completely misguided. But they got to them first. And they shouldn't have got to them first, because they're living in your country. You have primary access to these people. So why didn't you get to them first? In these marginalized neighborhoods where you have all these criminals, you have droves of people who you could turn into some of the most devoted pro-social actors in your society, and you're just not even reaching out to them.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about really violent drug gangs as being full of smart people with great leadership ability that has been channeled wrong. I mean, it would be, I mean, you think about the United States. This is a country founded on a revolution. Revolutionary spirit and zeal is behind a lot of the social movements that probably most of our listeners have supported, like civil rights and feminism and all kinds of movements for rights. Is there a way to channel that? Or do you see people trying to channel that revolutionary energy in terrorist or potential terrorist communities into nonviolent directions?
No, I don't. I don't see a lot of that rechanneling of energies in Western countries. There are some people who are doing some interesting work in non-Western countries. So you have someone like Gulala Ismail in Pakistan, who has a series of groups. One is called Youth Peace Network, and the other one is called Aware Girls. So Aware Girls is trying to get young women who are in these Taliban-controlled areas, or not controlled necessarily, but let's say heavily populated with Taliban supporters, and trying to actually fight for women's rights and things like that. and trying to get to the women first before they're taken away by someone else who's going to just basically rule them over like a slave. And they even have Youth Peace Network, which is like these small groups of young people who have just study groups. They're just sitting around and they're talking about, from what I understand, they're talking about like liberal democratic values and so forth, but it's not being imposed on them, right? It's not like some Western NGO showing up and saying, hey, you should believe in liberal democratic values and read these books. This is really sort of a bottom-up grassroots movement where there are young people who, in their society, proper liberal democratic values is revolutionary. And so they're studying and they're talking about things and they're holding debates and public lectures and stuff in these village areas, and sometimes at very great risk to themselves, because the Taliban could come and find them, or other groups could come and find them and kill them. So it is possible that you can have what we would consider to be non-revolutionary values, because we're living in societies that are some manifestation of that value. But for a lot of the world, that's still subversive. That's still, you know, not part of the mainstream. And so that can be a revolutionary movement in and of itself. But again, it should really be, you know, a grassroots movement. Those young people should want that kind of society. It shouldn't be imposed by anyone else.
Has law enforcement responded? In other words, what are, in the places that you're living and working, what are they doing well? Where are they failing? How are local, national, international bodies cooperating with each other and not?
Yeah, so it's sort of a debate within the world of policing is how much should police be involved in prevention? Because by definition, like, a police is there to intervene when someone commits a crime. But when someone's radicalizing, almost by definition, it's pre-crime, right? That's the point of a preventative strategy, is this person hasn't actually done anything wrong yet. They're just increasingly moving towards supporting a particular ideology. And by the way, to commit an act of terrorism, it is neither necessary nor sufficient to be radicalized. You see people who commit acts of terrorism. One day they were just acting out and kind of a little bit hostile, and the next day they drive a van over a group of people, and then they just say, I'm pledging allegiance to this group, because it politicizes their otherwise senseless act of violence. So you don't even need to be radicalized to commit an act of terrorism. And a lot of people who do get quote-unquote radicalized do not commit any acts of terrorism as well. So it puts police in a difficult situation where they don't really know what to do in these situations. But what I would say is that there is sort of an indirect way in which that they can help change the culture of a particular environment, and then that culture can then intervene. So for example, in certain areas, like in Molenbeek again, or in Sparkbrook, in a neighborhood in Birmingham, which I've spent some time in, you have sort of this culture of omerta, which has been created, this hear no evil, see no evil culture. Largely because there's a lot of organized crime in those areas, a lot of petty crime in those areas. They're so heavily crime-ridden that, one, people just sort of get exhausted. They can't be calling the police for everything. But also, when they do call the police for petty crimes or organized crimes, those people are usually arrested and they're back out on the street again in a day, and they probably usually know who ratted them out. So there's actual real repercussions to the community for calling someone out. So what happens is, over time, there's just sort of, yeah, this culture of omerta that gets created, where people who are not part of these criminal networks are just turning a blind eye to all the nefarious activity that's going on. And the police, for the most part, are kind of hanging out in their police stations. They come out if there's an actual crime taking place, or they drive their cars up and down the road, and they don't even get out of the cars, and they don't talk to people, but they're just kind of patrolling. And it reminds me a little bit of in the early days of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 to about 2007, right before General Petraeus started to really turn things around in Iraq. The American troops would just hang out in their bases, and then if there was an explosion or something, they would come out, they'd deal with it, and they would leave. But they were creating this vacuum, the security vacuum all around the areas where their bases were, which allowed groups like Al-Qaeda to come in and sort of enforce a type of justice. And that was part of Petraeus' strategy, was to say, no, we need U.S. soldiers on the streets, we need them on street corners, we need them patrolling, we need people when they walk out of their home, they see the presence to know that there is some real security being offered here. So that way they won't turn towards Al-Qaeda. And then that did help change things. I think a lot of that is happening in a lot of these marginalized neighborhoods where the police are not really providing a sense of security. I mean, I spent in Molenbeek, I was there 3 weeks every day in a row, right before coming to Santa Fe. And I don't think I ever saw a single police car or a police officer at any point from morning till night. I saw them at the police station, but I never saw them. I never even saw a car driving down the road, to be honest. And so there are things that the police can do to create a better sense of security, community relations, talking to people, letting them know that there will not be repercussions if you do, you know, come to us, so they can erode that culture of omerta. And once that, a culture of omerta is sort of almost like an autoimmune disorder. Basically, what it's doing is it's removing and weakening the immune system of the community to be able to respond to its own problems. And that's going to allow not only organized crime and petty crime networks to propagate, but if some radicalized individual comes in there and starts radicalizing people, it will allow terror networks to basically, or radicalized networks to propagate as well, because it's taking advantage of the same vulnerability in that community.
It seems like, I mean, you're talking about a local law enforcement perspective, but then on a much larger political perspective, it seems like if you were to be able to realize ideals of equality and full employment and equal rights, equal education, things like that, in each of these countries where people are vulnerable, that would be kind of the, if you're using the metaphor of the human body and the immune system, kind of the equivalent of having well-fed, well-exercised, healthy people that are less vulnerable to that kind of disease, if you can call terrorism a disease, where they wouldn't be able to recruit people.
Yeah, so the employment issue is interesting and it's controversial because, like I said, you do see people who had advanced degrees, who had good jobs, high-paying jobs. There was even professors of universities who went off and left and joined one of these groups. But it's true that the majority of people do tend to be more unemployed, or they're employed in something that's not particularly capturing their imagination, let's say, or all their potential as a person.
So boring jobs like street cleaning or burger flipping or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, even if we got to 100% employment in a place like Molenbeek and everyone was just doing some kind of hourly paid job, like being a janitor, like you said, flipping burgers or whatever, I don't think that's going to buffer them against radicalization. I mean, it may in one sense, in the sense that they have less time on their hands, that they're occupied more, they have, you know, working 40 hours a week or whatever, and then they're a little bit tired when they get home. But I don't really think that's going to do a lot, because that basically every day you're going to a job that just reminds you of, you know, how hopeless the society is that you're living in, and that this is your lot in life and this is the best that you can possibly achieve. I think people really need pathways to something meaningful and something spiritual and something more transcendent and profound. Again, you don't have to find that in a career. You can find that actually just through religion. That's not some violent, you know, form of that religion. You can find that through family, and a lot of people do. I mean, that is a lot of what buffers, like I said, a lot of people in these communities is, in fact, their close family relationships and is the religion. But of course, career and economic development can be part of that. It can be just one more thing that gives someone something hopeful, something to aspire to, that captures their imagination and gives them something worth living for right here in the current moment. And then it also sort of undermines the narrative that there's a subjugated population in this area and that you're being marginalized and there's injustice, because clearly you're not if there are those pathways available to you.
So given all you know and all that you've learned through your research, how would you advise policymakers? And if you could wave a magic wand and really make big changes, what would you do? I mean, not only to defuse terrorism, but to really meet the needs of the communities who are sending people into that life.
So yeah, I mean, there's sort of short-term and there's longer-term strategies. In the short run, what I would say is, if you know someone is on a watch list, if somehow you picked up the signal that this person is going down a radicalized pathway, for example, in France, 40% of the people who carried out a domestic attack were known to authorities beforehand. They were on a watch list. For someone like that, if you know that they're on a watch list, don't just wait around for them to actually do something. Don't wait for them to start actually making a bomb before you intervene. Start talking to the non-radical friends and family members, because I can promise you that the majority of the people around this person does not want them to go down that pathway. But either they don't know that this person is going down that pathway, or even if they do know, they don't know how to talk to that person. So one, you can equip them with the knowledge of what this person is doing, and two, give them guidance and training for being able to actually intervene and talk to this person and pull them off that pathway.
So you don't talk to the person directly, you talk to their friends and families.
You start there. And then if the friends and family want to bring in more specialists, if they say, you know, we need a therapist, we need a social worker, we need someone who knows a lot about theology because we can't really debate this person on the ideology, then those people, those resources should be available for the family members to bring that person in. That's sort of like the most direct intervention thing that you can possibly do. In the long, and so I guess it's sort of in the medium run would be something more like what I was saying about police, breaking down this culture of omerta, building community relationships, helping to create social cohesion within communities, improving parent and child relationships, because a lot of times you have a breakdown in family structures as well. So as a result, there's no hierarchy in some of these communities. They're just friends respecting other friends. So if one friend starts radicalizing, then they start going down that pathway and their parents just don't have a lot of influence over them. So again, you can try to do ways to mitigate these family relationships, help build up the family relationships, which sometimes can be related to employment. A lot of the guys I talked to said, you know, I don't respect my father. He's just hanging around the house all day. He doesn't do anything. He just goes and drinks tea with his buddies. And so he's not a real man, basically. And so there's no masculine, you know, role model. And so the role model becomes a sort of alpha male role model on the street, which then can easily be translated into a warrior carrying a gun somewhere and fighting for justice. That would be more sort of the medium run. Go talk to people, create NGOs, get the NGOs to go out and talk to people on the street, improve family relationships, improve police and community relationships, and improve social cohesion overall. But in the long run, we're going to have to ask ourselves this much more potent question, which is, these groups are offering something that's sacred. And in psychology literature, the way that we define sacred values is that it's non-utilitarian. You can't trade it off for material values. You would never sell maybe a watch, an heirloom that your dead father gave to you because it meant so much to you, even if you needed the money, right? Because it has some sacred value to it. But it can be religious or it can be political as well. It doesn't have to be just an object. It could be something abstract. And a lot of society is, what a society is offering is material values, is the pursuit of materialism, right? Saying that you pursue security, pursue comfort, pursue wealth, and that there's meaning to be found in that pursuit. And then what these other groups offer is saying, actually, we want you to give up all of that. We want you to give up security. We want to give up comfort, give up pursuit of material wealth for something that's more transcendent. In fact, give up your life even for something that can potentially change the world. And that's incredibly appealing. But of course, there are other pathways, from religious pathways to pro-social political movements, that also offer someone self-sacrifice. There's foreign aid workers all over the world right now who are engaged in the same sort of devoted action, who are sacrificing their comfort and material well-being in order to be in some difficult part of the world, providing vaccines for people or water or shelter for communities. So there are pathways for people to pursue these values. But this emptiness, this sort of this lack of talking about this need for transcendence, for meaning, for purpose, something that goes beyond the material, is having a vast array of effects on many people. It's leading to disaffection. And disaffection is sort of the bigger issue here, because there are many symptoms that come out of disaffection. And just one of them may be radicalization, but even getting involved, just losing a sense of civic duty, for example, is another symptom of disaffection, where people aren't voting in large numbers because they feel they can't have an impact on society. They don't want to do any kind of volunteer work. They don't want to help their community in any way. They become increasingly individualistic and just look after themselves, which puts them on a circular pathway, which is that the non-sacred life is essentially saying pursue an individualistic, materialistic pathway, and then they get disaffected because there's nothing meaningful in their life, so they continue to pursue that pathway, and they fall down this vicious circle. And this is really sort of, you know, big picture problems. There are people who are thinking about these issues, and like I said, there are a lot of civil society groups and NGOs, and I think a lot of like the millennial generation also, they want to have social impact more. They're not just pursuing money and the comfortable life. So there is this sort of awareness that I see amongst a variety of people all over the world, that there's a part of ourselves that we're sort of denying and that we haven't really paid part of our mainstream economic infrastructure. And I think we have to really address this tension in our human psychology if we really want a long-term strategy for providing people with meaningful and peaceful lives.
Nafis Hamid is a social psychologist who researches terrorism and radicalization. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.